Thank you. Good morning, and thank you so much for inviting me to this workshop. All right, water in the upper mantle today. And first, what do I mean by water? Because I use this word as in a very large sense. And actually, what I'm really going to talk about is hydrogen dissolved in various forms in all the phases of the mantle. So where do you find, why would I call it water? Well, it's not my idea, it's just kind of a tradition. Maybe it's because when we quantify the amount of hydrogen or water, we calculate it as part per million, so weight percent H2O. So maybe that's why we call it water. Okay, where do you find this water in your upper mantle? Of course, you can, there you go. Of course, there are melting fluids that circulate in the mantle, and water can be dissolved in that. But these are localized phases. Water can also be found in rare hydrous minerals that you find in the mantle, pyroxenes, phlogopites. But the main reservoir of water in the upper mantle is actually the so-called nominally anhydrous minerals, that is, the main phases of the mantle, like olivine pyroxene and garnet. And I say the main reservoir because if you calculate how much water you would have in the upper mantle, if you add it to the whole upper mantle of the whole Earth, it would be the equivalent of several oceans in mass of water. All right. So why do we care about water in the mantle? That's because a little bit of it can have a strong influence on key chemical and physical properties of the mantle. Here are some of the main ones. Of course, if you add a little bit of water, melting will occur at lower temperatures. Water is thought to have an influence on rheology. That is, if you add a little bit of water to olivine, it's supposed to be more deformable, weaker. And so this has important implication on geodynamic models of the Earth. I have a little asterisk here because there's a recent paper that came out in 2013 when they challenged this and say that maybe water in olivine does not have such a large influence on its rheology as previously thought. Anyway, I'll talk about a lot about this during the talk. And of course, water is important to interpret in the interpretation of remote sensing of the deep Earth. That include seismic wave attenuation, electrical, and thermal conductivity. So what I want to do in this talk is use real mantle, natural peridotite, upper mantle rocks, and measure the water content in them and try to map the distribution of water in the upper mantle, and also understand what controls the range of water contents that we observe in oceanic and continental settings. So we'll start with first, what type of samples do I work with? Well, I work with peridotites, and I work a lot with mantle xenoliths, which are a little chunk of mantle that some lavas pick up on their way up through the mantle and bring us pretty much intact to the surface. These lavas are typically alkali magmas, and if you go to cratonic settings, it's more like kimberlites. Okay, skip that. I want to address first a little problem we have sometimes with this type of data, is that by the time the piece of mantle here is picked up by the lava and brought up to the surface, sometimes the hydrogen will diffuse out of the minerals. And that is a problem because then if we measure water in the middle of an olivine like this, and some of it is gone, this water content that we'll measure will not represent what it was in the mantle, which is what we are interested in this talk. So I don't have to go through all this, but what I want to tell you here is that I have filtered all the data that we have on water in the mantle to only include the ones that I really think are mantle values, and the ones that I think I've lost water, I have excluded. Okay, let's start with the oceanic mantle, as we have talked about it this morning. What can we analyze for mantle rocks in the oceanic lithosphere? Well, we can, there are lots of data on just analyzing water in oceanic basalts. And so that's great, we have lots of data, but If you want to know the water content of the source, it's of course recalculated, and they have a problem with potential degassing. But we actually have real mantle rocks from oceanic settings. We have abyssal peridotites, which are actually outcrops of peridotites at mid-ocean ridges. And these are great, but the problem is they are very often altered by hydrothermal fluids circulating through them. So data are rare. And finally, we sometimes have mantle xenoliths in oceanic island basalts. And here I want to talk about those from Hawaii. All right, so peridotites, the main lithology of the upper mantle, is the result of partial melting. And so these rocks at Hawaii retain in their chemistry the signature of partial melting, like seen here, where you see a correlation between bulk rock aluminum content and that's kind of the amount of aluminum and chromium in spinel, and this correlates, and this can be explained by melting. What do we expect water to do during melting? It's hydrogen, so I will use water hydrogen as synonymous, but so hydrogen is an incompatible element, and that means it goes into the melt during partial melting. So the higher the degree of fusion, the higher the melting, we expect to have less and less water in a peridotite rock and its minerals. On the right, I show you the bulk rock water content on the xenoliths from Hawaii here, and there's not really a good correlation with an index of melting here. What I want to show you here is that the range of water content, 50 to 120 ppm, is within the range of what we think the MORP source is, kind of the lower part of the range. All right, so does water correlate with indices of melting? Well, the water content of pyroxenes do, and this is what these red arrows show you here. So this is great, right? So we think the range of water contents observed here is due to melting. Well, not so fast. When we try to model this by just taking reasonable sources, for example, the depleted mantle, the source of MORB, if you want, which so to contain about 115 ppm water, and we melt that with melting models, and this is what all these curves are, we see that all these melting curves fall systematically below our data. What it means is there's too much water in these Hawaiian peridotites to be explained simply by melting. So even if there are some correlation with the pyroxene water content, melting is not what controls these ranges. The other thing that typically happens to mantle rocks and peridotites is that after they are done melting, you have melts or fluids that circulate through them and re-enrich them in various incompatible elements, including water. And for example, some elements that are typically disturbed are the rare earth elements, like from lanthanum to lutetium. And this is the rare earth element in clinopyroxene. And when you have these steep patterns like this enriched in that rare earth element, it's very typical of metasomatism. And we see this melt rock interaction in these rocks also in the hafnium and neodymium isotopes. So could that explain our high water contents? Well, yes, it does. So if we do a simple mantle melt interaction modeling, we obtain these dotted blue and purple curves, and you see that they kind of are closer in amount of water to the data. So what we think is that the water is actually brought in by melts circulating through the peridotites, and these melts are probably the parent melts of the Hawaiian volcanics. Okay, this is a very crude sketch of Hawaii, and I'm sorry I put my plume vertical. Apparently it's not fashionable anymore. I didn't know, sorry. So what it represents is kind of a cross-section along the island, and our mantle xenoliths come from the island of Oahu, so it's not on the plume head. It actually erupted after the plume head moved away from from that location. The other thing that we know, and that's a study by my colleague Michael Bizimis, is that the xenoliths that we analyze are old. The rhenium depletion ages that we have are from 0.4 to 2 billion years old. That's much older than the age of the Pacific Ocean lithosphere at Hawaii, which is about 100 million years old. So what we think these xenoliths represent are actually chunks of all depleted recycled oceanic peridotites that are actually in the oceanic asthenosphere. They are being picked up by the plume and brought like this, underplating the Pacific oceanic lithosphere. And then after the plume passed, there was this so-called rejuvenated volcanism, that is the volcanism that occurred after the plume moved away from that location. So the parent melt of these rejuvenated volcanics re-enrich in water this old depleted peridotites, and that's what we have in our hand as xenoliths. Now I want to take a step back. This is water in the oceanic lithosphere, and this is all the data I know we have on real peridotites from the ocean. So in black, it's still the Hawaiian data. And the other data are from abyssal peridotites. And most abyssal peridotites have less water than Hawaii, which would be consistent with mostly with simple melting of a depleted mantle, which is consistent also by the fact that abyssal peridotites represent the very top column of the oceanic upper mantle. However, there's one location where somebody has measured high water content in autopyroxene as high as Hawaii. So as you can see, oceanic lithosphere, we don't have enough data to make big assumptions. And it seems to be heterogeneously hydrated, even if you are far away from a big plume like Hawaii. So that's all I have for you for oceanic mantle. Now we're going to move to the continental mantle. And especially we're going to go to cratonic lithosphere. And this is the third time I think you see this diagram. It's very popular. So. Anyway, it's a good representation of what the lithosphere looks like under cratons, which is the oldest part of continents. What it is, it's very thick, like 200 kilometers deep or more, and it's very old, several billion years old. It's kind of an iceberg, if you want, of lithosphere floating on the asthenosphere. And the mystery with these things is always, how come this big root here, this big lithosphere, has survived over a billion of years without being delaminated from below by the convecting asthenosphere? And the typical parameters that are invoked if you look for internal cause to the resistance of cratonic root delamination has always been the density, because the lithospheric roots of cratons have lost a lot of melt and the heavy elements are left, so it's buoyant. It has low temperature, and also it always, so this is known, that's a fact, and also it always has been hypothesized that it has low water content, because the water, as I said, likes to go into melt, so it's really left also, so it should be dry. And this is actually what we're going to look at today. I'm actually going to measure water in cratonic roots and see if it is dry or not. So for this, we're going to go to the Cap Val and the Siberia mainly. And if I have time, I'll address Colorado Plateau and Tanzania. Let's start with the Cap Val in southern Africa. The point of this slide is just to show you that I have a lot of different symbols for the data. And all that means is just different locations in the Cap Val cratons, different xenolith suites, each brought by one kimberlite pipe. So don't worry too much about the symbol for Cap Val, really. So this is all the data. What you see here is olivine, autopyroxene, clinopyroxene water content versus pressure. The pyroxene water content do not change much or do not see any systematic variation with pressure. However, in olivine, we seem to see a decrease in water content at the highest depths from 5 GPa to 6.5, and our deepest samples are very dry. I think I have, there you go. All right, so this is what we see under the Cap Val. So we have used this observation in 2010 to have a hypothesis that maybe cratons are the bottom of the cratonic lithosphere. The olivines there are very dry, which makes them very strong and undeformable. And this A strong layer at the bottom here helps cratons resisting delamination by the asthenosphere from below, in addition to the density and the temperature. And so on. All right, so this is Gracie's Cap Var. So the next step after this was, of course, is this visible in all cratons. So we went and analyzed Xenolus from the Siberian craton, and here you go. So first I should point out that this work was done by Luc Doucet, who is now at the University of Brussels. So this is olivine water content versus pressure, and there is very different profile in Cap Var and Siberia. Mainly Siberian olivines can be very wet, more than 300 ppm water, and some of the most water-rich olivines are found at the deepest levels that we have access to with pyridotites. That's very different from the Cap Var, which is dry down there. This is all the data sets, so this olivine, pyroxene, garnet water content versus pressure. So I just described the olivine one. But even the orthopyroxenes and the garnet, the most water-rich ones, are the deepest ones. All right, so what's going on? So first, I want to try to understand what controls these big ranges of water content. And we're going to do like we did in Hawaii. Is this partial melting? Is it metasomatism? All right, so let's start with partial melting. So what you see is olivine water content here, or bulk rock water content, versus various indices of melting. And the observation is that there is no correlation. Second, just like we had in Hawaii, we have too much water in these pyridotites to be explained simply by melting models. That would be roughly a melting curve here, and most of our xenoliths are too water rich. So the range of water contents observed in cratonic roots is not controlled by melting, or if it was in the past, it has been erased by other things, which is probably metasomatism. So before we look at this, We need to understand what type of rock we have here, because like I said, on the Cap Var, for example, we have xenoliths from several locations, kimberlite pipes, and each kimberlite pipes will sample a little region of the mantle, which will be completely different from another kimberlite pipe. So each region will have a different metasomatic history, not only in terms of composition of the fluids and melts, but also on multiple, on the amount of, maybe the age of the metasomatism, maybe how many metasomatic events there has been. So it's complicated, but at least what we have to do first is isolate each data set and see if we have trend in each. And it's easy for Siberia because we have analyzed only one location in Siberia, that's Udashnaya. And what we have is olivine water content correlates with the amount of clinopyroxene, the garnet water content correlates with the titanium content of garnet, and these are quite typical sign of metasomatism, even model metasomatism that recrystallize clinopyroxene. And we see it again in the trace element. These are the rare earths again, the blue ones. Which are the one with lots of water in their olivines, have more incompatible elements than the red ones here, which have less water. And we see the same thing in the Cap Var. Honestly, I don't have the time, but if you isolate the data set, you see also that it's all controlled by metasomatism or refertilization. So we are back to this initial observation. We're going to compare Cap Var and Siberia. And so what we have, what we know now, is that the water has been brought in by melts and fluids circulating through the mantle, and maybe along veins, shear zones, who knows exactly how it is physically. And we have very different water content profiles in olivines with depths. So that means that in Siberia, water is released during these metasomatic events at all pressures of the cratonic root. Whether in Cap Var we have release of water only at the shallowest levels. Okay, so why? I can tell you right away I don't have really an answer, but we can try to see if there are any differences between these two cratons. So both cratons are old, and some rocks are more than 3 billion years old. Kimberlite, various ages, but no big difference there. In both cratons, we have extensive evidence for metasomatism and many types of metasomatisms. In terms of composition. Dating the metasomatism is really difficult, but we think that in the Kavar, metasomatic events have occurred from the Archean to the Mesozoic. I don't have the answer for Siberia. And finally, both cratons are still deep. They still have a deep root of 200 kilometers or so. So, are there any differences? We think there is a difference in oxygen fugacity, which is just the degree of oxidation of the mantle. And what this diagram on top shows is just that the mantle becomes more and more reduced with depth, both in Siberia and Kavval. However, when you are at the deepest level, Siberia, here in yellow, is about one log unit more oxidized than the Kavval is. And why do we care about this? It's because depending on the oxidation state of the mantle, the composition of the fluids that are stable down there will be different, which is what you see with the bottom diagrams, which are the composition of the fluids versus pressure. And in blue, you have the amount of water, and in orange, you have the amount of methane, CH4. And because of this difference in oxygen fugacity, it turns out that there is much more methane in the fluids at the bottom of the Kavval than there are at the bottom of the Siberian craton. So what that means is a fluid that contains a lot of methane will have a lower water activity than a fluid that contains more water. And so an olivine or a mineral in equilibrium with that probably will have less water if it's reduced like this than oxidized. It's a hypothesis, but at least it's a difference. The other big difference between Kavval and Siberia is this, and I have no idea if this is related to water, but it's definitely something different. What you see here is a map of the seismic velocities at the level of the lower mantle here and level of the upper mantle here. And what that shows is that beneath Africa, there is a giant upwelling plume of hot material that comes up right beneath the Kavval and then kind of goes, this is a cross section towards the East African Rift or something. So it's beneath Kavval, but it's beneath Africa, but it's definitely not beneath Siberia. So I don't know if it's related, and I suppose we could we have to analyze other cratons in the world to see if there is a trend here, but that's the difference between the two cratons. Another question I have some people in the room later is how long the thing has been sitting beneath Africa. Try to see if we can relate it with the Asia metasomatism or something. Okay, let's go back to the role of water on the rheology of the mantle. And, hold it. So remember at the beginning, when we started studying only the Kavva, we proposed that the Kavva craton was underlain by a dry, contained the olivine down there was dry, so it would make it resistant to delamination. However, now that we have Siberia, this challenges this hypothesis. So we don't have an answer, but we have two scenarios. The xenoliths that we have, where am I? Here. The xenoliths that we have are not representative of the whole mantle. What we have in our rock collection is an over-representation of metasomatized mantle that are along these conduits of metasomatism here, whether they are shear zone or whatever. The overall mantle, like this green thing here, is dry, and we don't have that many samples of that, and that means water may still have a role in cratonic root long-term longevity. Scenario two is that our xenoliths are representative of the whole mantle lithosphere, so this thing is riddled with metasomatism that has completely transformed its chemistry like this. And but in that case, in the light of the data for Siberia, that means the water wouldn't have no role in cratonic crude long-term longevity. And in that case, maybe that paper that came out in 2013 may be right, that water does not have a large effect on olivine rheology. And to keep with the rheology theme, now I'd like to address whether water has a role in delaminating cratons, because we just studied two cratons that still have their roots, but there are cratons that have lost theirs or part of theirs. And could that be caused by water addition that would weaken the olivine and help delaminating the cratonic root? And for this, we can go to the Colorado Plateau, which is in the southwest USA. So the Colorado Plateau is not thick anymore. It is only 120 kilometers deep, so it has been delaminated from below. And there are two hypotheses for this. Either it's because it sits next to the Rio Grande Rift, so maybe a pooling of hot mantle may have caused the delamination, or it's because a subduction zone has been, I mean, a subduction event has been occurring beneath this region for the last 150 million years. That's the subduction of the Farallon Plate, which would have brought in water and maybe helped delaminate the Colorado Plateau route. The other location we're going to go is Tanzanian craton. So that craton is still deep. It still has all its roots, 200 kilometers or so. However, it sits right next to the East African Rift here, and on its edge, it's starting to be a little thinner. And we particularly see this in the xenoliths we studied, which are from a location here right at the edge, Labate. I have no idea how to pronounce this, but I'll do Labate. And so in the Tanzanian craton, in that location, you have two types of xenoliths. You have some, the shallowest ones, low pressure. They have more than, they are more than 2 billion years old, so they are cratonic xenoliths. And the deepest ones are young. So that means it's already replaced mantle. It's not cratonic anymore. All right, so what about the water? So I should point out that the Tanzanian craton is the work of Heiju Hui, and the Colorado Plateau, that's the work of Zeng Shui Li, and that was published in 2008. So I show you these data in comparison with the Kaval in pink and Siberia in yellow. So in Tanzania, all these xenoliths, whether it's olivine here on top or the pyroxene water contents at the bottom, are quite dry compared to Kaval and Siberia, so very dry mantle. Colorado, on the other hand, is quite wet, especially the pyroxene are exceptionally water-rich, and the olivine for the pressure are quite water-rich, up to 50 ppm water. So there you go. You have two settings where we think cratonic delamination is occurring. This one is dry, one's wet. So also for the Colorado Plateau, we have analyzed xenoliths from the Rio Grande Rift, Kilbourn Hole. That's the work of our student Lillian Schaefer, and those are the gray crosses. And these Rio Grande Rift xenoliths are not very water-rich. So probably this high water content Colorado Plateau is indeed coming from the Farallon slab. And at the time, we argued that it's probably helped thinning the cratonic root, and it may have, I don't know. However, here, if there is any thinning of the Tanzanian craton on its eastern margin, it's certainly not linked to water because it's quite dry. No, I still have time, yes, okay. Now, last thing I have is just a comparison of global data set for water in the mantle. 1 minute, okay, I'll be quick. So olivine water content, Birkrock water content versus pressure, pyroxene. This is the craton data we just discussed, nothing new. Off craton, they fall on top of the cratonic data, nothing new, nothing different. And this is the oceanic water content that we discussed earlier. So the point here is that everything is, for the Birkrock, for example, is within between 10 and 150 ppm typically. So it's very similar to what is thought to be the morph source in terms of water content. There is no big difference between cratons, off cratons, the oceanic type of mantle in terms of water. And conclusions? Pretty much what I said, not enough data for the oceanic lithosphere. Cratonic lithosphere, water is controlled by metasomatism and oxygen fugacity. Water content is pretty much similar in continental oceanic lithosphere, and there are a few extremes that we have discussed. And the fact that we don't have really a correlation between deep cratonic root and dry and thin cratonic roots and wet. We don't see that, it seems, maybe challenges the assumption that water has an important role in the stabilization and destruction of cratons. And that's all I got. There, you can know more at AGU if you go. Thank you.